Cladex, 2018. Then, on May 15, 2018, inside the darkened ballroom of Washington's Mandarin Oriental Hotel, foreboding military music introduced another pandemic biowarfare preparation exercise hosted by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, formerly the Hopkins Population Center, which Gates and NIH fund. The day-long event, dubbed Clade-X, simulated the response to a fictitious bioengineered pathogen for which there is no vaccine. Hoping to reduce world population, an elite cult released their genetically engineered bug from a Zurich lab. The disease spreads first to Germany and Venezuela, and then to the United States, killing 100 million people globally as healthcare systems collapsed, panic spread, the U.S. stock market crashed. The simulation included a series of National Security Council convened meetings of 10 U.S. government leaders played by individuals prominent in the fields of national security or epidemic response. The exercise emphasized the need for militarized pandemic responses and explored strategies for controlling media and social media. It was a training drill to prepare political, bureaucratic, military, and intelligence officials to support the coup d'etat against American democracy and the U.S. Constitution. Participating were a kitchen cabinet of former top leaders of the FDA and CDC, as well as a former CIA general counsel. Playing themselves were ex-Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and Indianapolis Congresswoman Susan Brooks. Daschle, a former Army intelligence officer who was among the targets of the 2001 anthrax-laced letters, became a pharmaceutical industry lobbyist by 2018. Susan Brooks, the so-called member from Eli Lilly, founded the Congressional Biodefense Caucus. She also introduced a successful bill in 2015, the Social Media Working Group Act of 2014, to establish a social media bureau within the Department of Homeland Security to facilitate censorship of social media during national emergencies. Another of her bills in 2015 sought to streamline implementation of coercive vaccination programs by the federal government during pandemics. Clade-X live-streamed on Facebook before about 150 invited guests, including carefully selected representatives of major media. The simulation left his adulatory press quaking with fear. This mock pandemic killed 150 million people. Next time, it might not be a drill, Jeff Bezos's Washington Post headlined. The New York Post assured readers that the world is completely unprepared for the next pandemic. As the Post's reporter summarized, the simulation mixed details of past disasters with fictional elements to force government officials and experts to make the kinds of key decisions they could face in a real pandemic. It was a tense day. The exercise was inspired in part by the troubled response to the Ebola epidemic of 2014. Unlike Ebola, which spreads through direct contact and bodily fluids, this latest was a flu-like respiratory virus which would spread far more easily from person to person through coughing and sneezing. In the exercise, schools closed, the demand for surgical masks and respirators far exceeded supply, and hospitals in the United States were quickly overwhelmed. Among the difficult questions, an entry ban on flights from other countries, who should get the vaccines first? It's noteworthy that none of the Hopkins simulations contemplate the efficacy of repurposed medications to mitigate or end the pandemic. And none of them allow for soul-searching about the abolition of constitutional rights and the wholesale destruction of America's political and judicial systems in favor of a tyrannical medical and military junta. None of them recognize that there is no pandemic exception in the United States Constitution. Instead, they were too busy wargaming a high-level mutiny against American democracy. All of the Hopkins simulation stories end with the same affirmations. the advisability of militarized police state response, and the dire need for broadly deployable mRNA vaccines, upon which Gates and Fauci had already invested billions of dollars. Players underscored the need for the United States to go from bug to drug faster. And each simulation highlighted the so-called need to quarantine and isolate the healthy, censor criticism of the Gates-Fauci vaccines, and coerce the population into receiving vaccines rushed into distribution, all in opposition to logic, common sense, and previous public health practices. Hopkins Center Director Tom Inglesby explained that the event's immediate purpose was to provide experiential learning for new decision-makers in the Trump administration. Of course, the event's embedded press corps lauded Gates as the hero of the day, the beneficent billionaire whose genius alone would save us from the murderous contagion. An adulatory New Yorker article, The Terrifying Lessons of a Pandemic Simulation, giddily embraced the images of a nation at war, with Gates as the general atop his gleaming white steed. Philanthropist-in-chief Bill Gates drew on models developed by the Gates-funded Institute for Disease Modeling, IMHE, a venture founded by his former Microsoft colleague Nathan Myhrvold, to warn that, at our current state of readiness, roughly 33 million people would die within the first 6 months of a global pandemic similar to the 1918 flu. Gates would deploy his IMHE minions in January 2020 to grotesquely exaggerate the COVID-19 predicted mortalities, 22 million dead in 12 months, to justify Tony Fauci's draconian lockdown. Where did the mock virus originate? In this scenario, someone has genetically modified a mostly harmless para-influenza virus to kill, recounted MIT Technology Review. The fictional culprit is a Brighter Dawn, a shadowy group promoting the philosophy that fewer people, a lot fewer, would be a good thing for planet Earth. Johns Hopkins pandemic specialist Eric Toner created the scenario after carrying out meticulous research to come up with a plausible threat using real virology and epidemiological models. The result was so realistic that the organizers chose not to present too many details. A clear strategic objective for Gates and Fauci was the repetition of the message that a global pandemic was inevitable, that only mandatory vaccines could avert catastrophe, and that obliteration of civil rights will be required. Most astonishing was their capacity to mobilize the obliging global media to uncritically swallow and promote these propositions in complete contradiction of all previously accepted science and history. That same month, PBS's NewsHour, once revered as the most incorruptible of all U.S. television media, ran an adoring feature on Dr. Fauci, prominently touting the need for a universal flu vaccine in a two-part report on why another flu pandemic is likely just a matter of when. PBS cut to a tour of Fauci's Vaccine Research Center with Dr. Barney Graham, co-inventor of Moderna's mRNA vaccine. In the next segment, the PBS reporter asked Dr. Fauci about a shot to protect against all known and unknown strains of the flu virus. Dr. Fauci replied, "Several years ago, I wouldn't have been able to give you even an approximation of when that would be, because the science wasn't giving us the clues that we could actually do that. Now, with these exquisite techniques of structure-based vaccine design, I think we are in shooting distance." Dr. Fauci continued, "We have got to be able to have something that, when a new pandemic virus emerges, we already have something on the shelf to do something about it, something that you could make, and it would be usable so that when you stockpile it, it really is a stockpile." The show was functionally an infomercial for Moderna and mRNA vaccines. PBS didn't mention that Dr. Fauci's NIAID had pumped massive funding into Moderna's vaccine, or that NIAID claimed patent rights and stood to profit handsomely from its approval. Nor did PBS acknowledge that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had previously given PBS NewsHour millions of dollars, or that by 2019, Gates had also bet millions on Moderna's mRNA vaccine. Gates owns a substantial equity stake in the company. In September 2019, the Gates-funded Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security followed up on its Clade X event by issuing an 84-page report, Preparedness for a High-Impact Respiratory Pathogen Epidemic. The report focused on the only endpoint that seemed to really concern Gates, the Gates-Fauci mRNA vaccine project. If there was any doubt that pushing mRNA vaccine was the entire purpose of the exercise, the white paper cleared that up. The Clade X summary called for making the top priority of all government, media, and biosecurity players the coordinated drive for R&D aimed at rapid vaccine development for novel threats and distributed surge manufacturing. Nucleic acid, RNA, and DNA-based vaccines are widely seen as highly promising and potentially rapid vaccine development pathways, though they have not yet broken through with licensed products. Both Gates and Fauci had already invested such enormous financial resources in that technology. In this light, the simulations can be interpreted as marketing and public relations exercises designed to recruit and train political, military, media, and public health officials to advance their enterprise using censorship, propaganda, and state-sponsored violence if necessary. The report concluded with a revealing warning about biosafety, particularly for countries that are funding research with the potential to result in accidents with pathogens that could initiate high-impact respiratory pandemics. The report warned that the possibility of deliberate release could substantially add to the extraordinary consequences that would follow a naturally occurring pandemic event with the same agent. Mass vaccination strategies should be developed and put in place to increase immediate access. Put simply, through the medium of this sponsored report, Gates is saying that we need a rapid mass vaccination strategy in place to anticipate the accidental or deliberate release of the kind of enhanced pathogens that his working partner, Dr. Fauci, was funding the development of in Wuhan under the pretext of vaccine research. Though Gates's simulation highlighted the need for masks and respirators, Gates, Dr. Fauci, and Kadlec ignored stockpiling these items, and the same for any antiviral drugs that might successfully treat sick people. Instead, they were laser-focused on next-gen vaccines, on compulsory administration to healthy uninfected populations, on censorship and other coercive devices, on constructing and controlling global health agencies, and on surveillance technologies. Global Preparedness Monitoring Board. Later, in May 2018, with imprimatur from the WHO and the World Bank Group, Gates created a kind of permanent standing committee called the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, GPMB, including some of the most powerful global public health kingpins, to institutionalize the lessons derived from all these scenario planning drills. The Global Committee would serve as the real-life authoritative collective for imposing rules during the upcoming pandemic. This so-called independent monitoring and accountability body's purpose was to validate the imposition of police state controls by global and local political leaders and technocrats, endorsing their efforts to take the kind of harsh actions that Gates' simulation modeled, subduing resistance, ruthlessly censoring dissent, isolating the healthy, collapsing economies, and compelling vaccination during a projected worldwide health crisis. GPMB's board includes a pantheon of technocrats whose cumulative global power to dictate global health policy is virtually irresistible. Anthony Fauci, Sir Jeremy Ferrer of Wellcome Trust, Chris Elias of BMGF, China's CDC Director George Gao, Russian Health Minister Veronika Skvortsova, WHO's Health Director Michael Ryan, its former Director Gro Harlem Brundtland, its former Programming Director Ilona Kickbush, and UNICEF's Henrietta Holzman IV, who is former Director of USAID that used to be a reliable CIA front. In June 2019, about 20 weeks before the start of the COVID pandemic, Dr. Michael Ryan, Executive Director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, summarized the conclusions of GPMB's pandemic report, warning that we are entering a new phase of high-impact epidemics that would constitute a new normal where governments worldwide would strengthen control and restrict the mobility of citizens. Crimson Contagion 2019. That August, not even 10 weeks before the first COVID-19 infections were reported in Wuhan, a 2019 war game codenamed Crimson Contagion capped 8 months of planning overseen by Robert Kadlec, who was by then President Trump's disaster response leader. Also involved in this virus war game scenario was Anthony Fauci, representing the NIH, Dr. Robert R. Redfield of the CDC, and HHS Secretary Alex Azar. The HHS Office of Preparedness and Response teamed with the top spooks at the National Security Council to lead the four-day nationwide functional exercise. So now Kadlec, who had for 20 years been writing scripts for using a pandemic to overthrow democracy and curtail constitutional rights, was in a perfect position to do just that. With this virus simulation, he included all the key players who would manage what was to become a de facto coup d'etat 60 days hence. While earlier simulations functioned as training drills for high-level political, military, press, intelligence agency, and regulatory commissars, the 2019 Crimson Contagion simulation functioned as a nationwide crusade to evangelize state-level health bureaucracies, municipal officials, hospital and law enforcement agencies across America with the messages developed in the preceding simulations. Under a veil of enforced secrecy, organizers staged the Crimson Contagion exercise nationwide at over 100 centers. Participation included 19 federal departments and agencies, 12 key states, 15 tribal nations and pueblos, 74 local health department and coalition regions, 87 hospitals, and over 100 healthcare and public health private sector partners. The simulation scenario envisioned a novel influenza pandemic originating in China labeled H7N9. As with COVID-19, air travelers rapidly spread the deadly respiratory illness across the globe. In this scenario, by the time U.S. health officials first identify the virus in Chicago, it is already galloping like the Grim Reaper across other metropolitan areas, forcing the HHS secretary to declare a national public health emergency. The WHO delays a month before declaring a pandemic. The multi-state, multi-regional exercise that took place just months before the real-world COVID-19 pandemic focused on critical infrastructure protection, economic impact, social distancing, scarce resource allocation, prioritization of vaccines, and other countermeasures, again, not including therapeutic medicines. The Crimson Contagion exercise achieved eerily accurate forecasting, with numbers that precisely predicted the official casualty data for COVID-19. 110 million forecasted illnesses, 7.7 million predicted hospitalizations, and 568,000 deaths in the United States alone. The draft report, dated October 19, 2019, and marked not to be disclosed, didn't become public until the New York Times obtained a copy under the Freedom of Information Act and published a front-page article on March 19, 2020, 8 days after the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Only under pressure from another FOIA request did Cadlec's HHS Office of the Assistant Secretary of Preparedness and Response release the January 2020 After Action Crimson Contagion Report the following September. The Times story contained this paragraph. Quote, the October 2019 report documents that officials at the Department of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services, and even at the White House's National Security Council, were aware of the potential for a respiratory virus outbreak originating in China to spread quickly to the United States and overwhelm the nation, end quote. The New York Times takeaway missed altogether the larger and more significant stories, that the Crimson Contagion's planners precisely predicted every element of the COVID-19 pandemic, from the shortage of masks to specific death numbers, months before COVID-19 was ever identified as a threat, and that their overarching countermeasure was the pre-planned demolition of the American Constitution by a scrupulously choreographed palace coup. The Crimson Contagion draft report complains that existing federal funding sources were insufficient to combat a pandemic and concluded predictably that government officials needed far more money and far more power. A significant topic of concern centered around the inadequacies of existing executive branch and statutory authorities to provide HHS with the requisite mechanisms to serve successfully as the lead federal agency in response to an influenza pandemic. The team noted that the group concluded they would soon need to move toward aggressive social distancing, even at the risk of severe disruption to the nation's economy and the daily lives of millions of Americans. Top off 2000 to 2007. In the course of researching this book, I discovered that beginning in 2000, the security, military, police, and intelligence agencies have been secretly staging other mass simulations under the code name Topoff, of which the public is almost entirely unaware. Each of these functioned as training exercises for the lockstep imposition of global totalitarianism. Many of these drills have involved tens of thousands of local police, health officials, and emergency responders across the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Europe, as well as representatives from the FBI, the State Department, the intelligence agencies, and private corporations from chemical, petroleum, financial, telecom industries, and health sectors. Four top-off, top-official exercises between May 2000 and 2007 mobilized DOJ, FBI, and FEMA officials, staging scenario planning around chemical and bioweapons attacks. The first of them, in May 2000, modeled chemical biological attacks in Denver, Colorado, and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, exploring logistics for quarantining an entire state, Colorado. The executive summary complains that stronger measures to protect the local Colorado citizens were not implemented, and warns that to survive such a disaster, the state must immediately take quick and decisive action to quarantine the population, including the enforcement of an unprecedented no-contact-out-of-your-home policy that became the hallmark of the response to COVID-19 20 years later. The Department of Homeland Security sponsored Topoff 2 in May 2003, including more than 8,000 participants in Seattle and Chicago, as well as significant participation by the Canadian government. Topoff 3 in April 2005 simulated biological and chemical attacks in New Jersey and Connecticut, involving more than 20,000 participants from over 250 federal, state, and local agencies, private businesses, volunteer groups, and international organizations. Canada and the UK coordinated simultaneous exercises. Top Off 4, running from October 15 to October 24, 2007, involved more than 23,000 participants from government and the private sector, simulating attacks in Guam, Portland, and Phoenix. In Washington, D.C., the State Department activated an exercise task force and participated in high-level meetings with other department and agency decision-makers, including American embassies in Canberra, Ottawa, and London. "These are brainwashing exercises," says former CIA officer and whistleblower Kevin Shipp. "Getting all of these thousands of public health and law enforcement officials to participate in blowing up the U.S. Bill of Rights in these exercises, you basically have obtained their prior sign-off on torpedoing the Constitution to overthrow its democracy. They know that none of these participants are going to suddenly start soul-searching when the real thing happens. The CIA has spent decades studying exactly how to control large populations using these sorts of techniques." Shipp adds, "We are all subjects now being manipulated in a vast population-wide Milgram experiment, with Dr. Fauci playing the doctor in the white lab coat, instructing us to ignore our virtues and our conscience and obliterate the Constitution." Event 201, October 2019. Under Gates' direction in mid-October 2019, only 2 months after Crimson Contagion and 3 weeks after U.S. intelligence agencies believe that COVID-19 had begun circulating in Wuhan, the cabal of potentates and institutions that compose the biosecurity cartel began preparing decision-makers for the mass eviction of informed critics of the vaccine industry from social media. That month, Gates personally organized yet another training and signaling exercise for government biosecurity functionaries. This war game consisted of 4 tabletop simulations of a worldwide coronavirus pandemic. Participants included a group of high-ranking kahunas from the World Bank, the World Economic Forum, Bloomberg Johns Hopkins University Population Center, the CDC, various media powerhouses, the Chinese government, a former CIA NSA director, vaccine maker Johnson & Johnson, the globe's largest pharmaceutical company, finance and biosecurity industry chieftains, and the president of Edelman, the world's leading corporate PR firm. Conspiracy-minded critics dubbed this cabal the Deep State. The World Economic Forum director Klaus Schwab has christened their agenda the Great Reset. Event 201 was a signaling exercise, but it was also, as we shall see, a training run for a government in waiting. Its principals would quickly move into key positions to run pandemic response a few months later. At Gates's direction, the participants role-played members of a pandemic control council, wargaming a contagion that serves as pretext for this insurgency against American democracy. They drilled a retinue of psychological warfare techniques for controlling official narratives, silencing dissent, forcibly masking large populations, and leveraging the pandemic to promote mandatory mass vaccinations. Needless to say, there was little talk of building or fortifying immune systems, existing off-the-shelf remedies, or off-patent therapeutic drugs and vitamins. Instead, there was abundant palaver about expanding government's authoritarian powers, imposing draconian restrictions, curtailing traditional civil rights, which might include of rights of assembly, free speech, private property, jury trials, due process, and religious worship, as well as promoting and coercing the uptake of new, patentable antiviral drugs and vaccines. The participants walked through imaginary global coronavirus contagion scenarios that focused on fear-mongering, blanket censorship, mass propaganda, and police state strategies culminating in compulsory max vaccination. As with the Clade X simulation, the most trusted pharma-friendly media attended. Forbes and Bloomberg participated in the exercise, which focused on wargaming the medical cartel's censorship initiative. The Bloomberg Foundation is a major funder of the Johns Hopkins Center. Oddly, Gates later claimed that this simulation didn't occur. On April 12, 2020, Gates told BBC, "Now here we are. We didn't simulate this. We didn't practice. So both the health policies and economic policies, we find ourselves in uncharted territory." Unfortunately for that whopper, the videos of the event are still available across the internet. They show that Gates and team did indeed simulate health and economic policies. It's hard to swallow that Gates had forgotten. Organizers billed Event 201 as a vehicle for delineating areas where public-private partnerships will be necessary during the response to a severe pandemic in order to diminish large-scale economic and societal consequences. They reminded attendees that experts agree that it is only a matter of time before one of these epidemics becomes global. Event 201 was as close as one could get to a real-time simulation. It was a meeting of a hypothetical pandemic emergency board in the same week that COVID-19 was already claiming its first victims in Wuhan. "We're not sure how big this could get, but there's no end in sight," warns one hypothetical physician in an opening briefing. Gates's simulated coronavirus epidemic was far worse than the authentic COVID-19 outbreak that would hit America just weeks later. The simulated version caused 65 million deaths at the 18-month endpoint and global economic collapse lasting up to a decade. Compared to the Gates simulation, therefore, the actual COVID-19 crisis is a bit of a dud. Public health officials claim 2.5 million deaths attributed to COVID globally over 13 months. The death counts from COVID in our real-life COVID-19 predicament are highly inflated and questionable. Further, the death of 2.5 million must be put in the context of a global population of 7.8 billion, with around 59 million deaths expected annually in any event. Event 201's predictions of decade-long economic collapse will probably prove more accurate, but only because of the draconian lockdown promoted by both Gates and Dr. Fauci. The theme of Event 201 was that such a crisis would prove an opportunity to promote new vaccines and tighten information and behavioral controls through propaganda, censorship, and surveillance. Gates's script anticipates vast anti-vaccine resistance triggered by mandates and fanned by internet posts. Muzzling talk of lab generation. 5 months before WHO declared a global pandemic, at a time when 99.999% of Americans had never heard the phrase gain of function, key government officials were already planning strategies for suppressing public discussion of the potential that a coronavirus might have been deliberately manipulated to enhance its pathogenicity and transmissibility in humans. One of their central fixations was how to silence rumors that the coronavirus was laboratory-generated. Event 201's fourth simulation anticipated the manipulation and control of public opinion and muzzling any colloquy about artificially enhanced pathogens. Everyone voiced their urgent concerns that authorities must instantly squelch and discredit any speculation that someone deliberately or accidentally released a lab-made bug. This segment is most revealing for its uncannily accurate prediction of democracy's current crisis. The fundamental assumption of all participants was that censorship and propaganda are legitimate exercises of federal power. The participants discussed mechanisms for stamping out disinformation and misinformation by flooding the media with propaganda, good information, imposing penalties for spreading falsehoods, and discrediting dissent, the anti-vaccination movement. What follows are thumbnail portraits of some of the participants in this aspect of the operation, along with accounts of their specific comments and actions. George Gao, the director of the Chinese Center for Disease Control, CCDC, worried about how to suppress the inevitable rumors that the virus is laboratory-generated. People believe this is a man-made and that some pharmaceutical company made the virus. 2 months after speaking those words, Gao himself would lead the Chinese effort to tamp down rumors of lab creation. Gao also orchestrated the Chinese government drive to vaccinate 1 billion Chinese citizens. Dr. Tara Kirk-Sell, a senior scholar at Bloomberg School of Health's Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, worried that pharmaceutical companies are being accused of introducing the virus so they can make money on drugs and vaccines. "We have seen public faith in their products plummet," she notes with alarm, that unrest due to false rumors and divisive messaging is rising and is exacerbating spread of the disease as levels of trust fall and people stop cooperating with response efforts. "This is a massive problem, one that threatens governments and trusted institutions." Sell reminds her confederates that, "We know that social media is now the primary way that many people get their news, so interruptions to these platforms could curb the spread of misinformation." "There are many ways," Dr. Sell advises, "for government and industry allies to accomplish this objective. Some governments have taken control of national access to the internet. Others are censoring websites and social media content. And a small number have shut down internet access completely to prevent the spread of misinformation. Penalties have been put in place for spreading harmful falsehoods, including arrests." Like many other Event 201 collaborators, Sell moved into government service soon after declaration of the pandemic. Since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. Sell has worked as a kind of United States Minister of Truth, coordinating U.S. government and WHO efforts to quash, to dissent and discredit, vilify and gaslight dissenters. She calls her occupation by the Orwellian term infodemiology, which she describes as tracking spread of misinformation, dissenting opinions, and curtailing its spread through risk communication and censorship. Jane Halton served Australia as both health and finance ministers and is a board member of Australia's ANZ Bank. ANZ funds Australia's large and influential vaccine sector. Halton is one of the authors of Australia's oppressive No Jab, No Pay policy. She was the former president of WHO's World Health Assembly. Today, she is chair of Gates's Global Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, CEPI, which serves the role of diverting philanthropic and government financing toward the development of pandemic vaccines by profit-making pharmaceutical companies. She assured her fellow Event 201 participants that, behind the scenes, the Gates Foundation was already creating algorithms to sift through information on these social media platforms to protect the public from dangerous thoughts and information. In March of 2020, Halton joined the executive board of the Australian National COVID-19 Coordination Commission, which imposed the world's most draconian lockdown and the most dramatic abridgments of civil rights in that nation's history. Chen Huang, an Apple research scientist, Google scholar, and the world's leading expert on tracking and tracing and facial recognition technology, role-plays the newscaster reporting on government countermeasures. He blames riots on anti-vaccine activists and, approvingly, predicts that Twitter and Facebook will cooperate in identifying and deleting a disturbing number of accounts dedicated to spreading this information about the outbreak and to implement internet shutdowns to quell panic. Matthew Harrington, Director of Global Operations and Digital Communications, Edelman, the world's largest public relations firm, which represents Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Microsoft, agrees that social media must fall in line to promote government policy. "I also think we're at a moment where the social media platforms have to step forward and recognize the moment to assert that they're a technology platform and not a broadcaster is over. They, in fact, have to be a participant in broadcasting accurate information and partnering with the scientific and health communities to counterweight, if not flood, the zone of accurate information. Because to try to put the genie back in the bottle of the misinformation and disinformation is not possible. Stephen Redd, the Admiral of the United States Public Health Service and Assistant Surgeon General, has the sinister notion that government should mine social media data to identify and collect data on Americans with negative beliefs. I think with the social media platforms, there's an opportunity to understand who it is that's susceptible to misinformation. So I think there's an opportunity to collect data from that communication mechanism. A couple of months after expressing these ideas, Redd assumed his new post, Deputy Director of CDC, managing the COVID countermeasures. Adrian Thomas, VP Global Strategy, Programs and Public Health for Johnson & Johnson, the world's largest pharmaceutical company, announced some important news to share from our member companies, Pharma. We are doing clinical trials in new antiretrovirals and, in fact, in vaccines. He recommends a strategy to address the problems that will inevitably badger these companies when rumors were actually spreading that their shoddily tested products are causing deaths, and so patients are not taking them anymore. He suggests, maybe we're in the mistake of reporting and counting all the fatalities and infections. This worry may explain why federal regulators chose to deliberately maintain a dysfunctional surveillance system designed to hide more than 99% of vaccine injuries. Thomas has manned Johnson & Johnson's pandemic response and vaccine development program since March 2021. Former CIA Deputy Director Avril Haines unveiled a strategy to flood the zone with propaganda from trusted sources, including influential community leaders as well as health workers. She warns about false information that is starting to actually hamper our ability to address the pandemic, then we need to be able to respond quickly to it. On April 11, 2021, President Biden appointed Haines as Director of National Intelligence, now the highest official in charge of pandemic response. Matthew Harrington, Edelman CEO, observes that the Internet, which once promised to decentralize and democratize information, now needs to be centralized. I think, just to build a little bit on what Avril said, is I think, as in previous conversations where we've talked about centralization around management of information or public health needs, there needs to be a centralized response around the communications approach that then is cascaded to informed advocates represented in the NGO communities, the medical professionals, etc. Edelman boasts that tech is its biggest client, followed closely by pharma. Microsoft is Edelman's most important account. Dr. Tom Inglesby is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. He is an advisor to NIH, the Pentagon, and Homeland Security. Like many other Event 201 participants, Inglesby migrated immediately into real-life management of the crisis. 3 months later, he would move over to HHS as senior advisor of the COVID-19 response. Inglesby agrees that greater centralized control is needed. When asked, "You mean centralized international?" Matthew Harrington, Edelman, replies that information access should be centralized on an international basis because I think there needs to be a central repository of data, facts, and key messages. Hasti Tagi, media advisor, sums up, "The anti-vaccine movement was very strong, and this is something specifically through social media that has spread. So as we do the research to come up with the right vaccines to help prevent the continuation of this, how do we get the right information out there? How do we communicate the right information to ensure that the public has trust in these vaccines that we're creating?" Kevin McAleese, a communications officer for Gates-funded agricultural projects observes that, to me, it is clear countries need to make strong efforts to manage both mis- and disinformation. We know social media companies are working around the clock to combat these disinflation campaigns. The task of identifying every bad actor is immense. This is a huge problem that's going to keep us from ending the pandemic and might even lead to the fall of governments, as we saw in the Arab Spring. If the solution means controlling and reducing access to information, I think it's the right choice. Dr. Tom Inglesby, Johns Hopkins, concurs, asking if, in this case, do you think governments are at the point where they need to require social media companies to operate in a certain way? Lavan Tharoor, Singapore's finance minister, suggests that the government might make examples by arresting dissidents with governments on enforcement actions against fake news. Some of us, this new regulations are come in place about how we deal with fake news. Maybe this is a time for us to showcase some cases where we are able to bring forward some bad actors and leave it before the courts to decide whether they have actually spread some fake news. Sophia Borges, head of the New York office of the UN, spoke of putting out positive stories about people who'd beaten the disease and having a centralized source of information and a world body that could garner the respect of everyone. I think the WHO in this instance might be that source of information. Adrian Thomas added, "It's important to think about what atypical players in the private sector can we bring to bear in this. Bringing multinational pharmaceutical companies to talk about why their products are safe could be seen as non-credible." Gates's Event 201 Global Pandemic War Game quickly demonstrated that it was reaching and indoctrinating its intended audiences, the globe's top-level decision-makers. A week after Event 201, presidential aspirant Joe Biden read a Washington Post article about the follow-up to the Event 201 report, co-authored by the Hopkins Center for Health Security. According to a newly invented Global Health Security Index assessing 195 countries, no country, the United States included, is fully prepared to respond to a deliberate or accidental threat with the potential to wipe out humanity. Biden tweeted a response on October 25, 2019. "We are not prepared for a pandemic. We need leadership that focuses on real threats and mobilizes the world to stop outbreaks before they reach our shores." At the end of November 2019, Rob Butler, the head of WHO Europe's Vaccine Preventable Diseases and Immunization Program from 2014 to 2018, told the European Scientific Conference on Applied Infectious Disease Epidemiology that vaccine hesitancy must be tackled and immunization is a best buy. The triumph of the military intelligence complex, intelligence agencies, and COVID-19. In November 2020, the British spy agency MI6 announced that its spooks would be surveilling foreigners all over the world, presumably including Americans who questioned official orthodoxies about COVID-19 vaccines, declaring the launch of an offensive cyber operation to disrupt anti-vaccine propaganda. The foreign branch hinted that it would henceforth target individuals who asked awkward or impudent questions about vaccines or questioned official COVID proclamations or countermeasures. The agency promised to deploy the same arsenal of monitoring and harassment weaponry and dirty tricks that it formerly reserved for terrorists. According to The Times, the spy agency is using a toolkit developed to tackle disinformation and recruitment peddled by Islamic State. A government source assured the paper they weren't kidding around. GCHQ has been told to take out anti-vacciners online and on social media. There are ways they have used to monitor and disrupt terrorist propaganda. Federal law forbids U.S. spy agencies from spying on or surveilling U.S. citizens, but the Western intelligence bureaucracies work in collaboration with one another, and the CIA often deploys European, Israeli, and Canadian agencies as surrogates to skirt U.S. laws. In August 2020, after I appeared as a keynote speaker before an estimated crowd of 1.2 million democracy and civil rights advocates from every European nation protesting COVID restrictions at a peace and justice rally in Berlin, Germany's domestic intelligence agency announced that it would begin monitoring the top leaders of the group that invited me. The spy agency accused COVID protesters of trying to permanently undermine trust in state institutions and their representatives, according to the news agency AFP. Now the definition of terror is so broad, says former CIA official Kevin Shipp, that any mention of COVID vaccines comes under their purview. These were the first explicit acknowledgments of the pervasive involvement by Western intelligence agencies in the vaccine enterprise that the global press has long overlooked. As two decades of germ game simulations foreshadowed, U.S. and foreign clandestine agencies have a secretive but dominating presence in the COVID-19 pandemic response. Intelligence community alumni and active officers occupy key positions in the international agencies that promote global vaccinations. For example, President Biden's director of USAID is former WHO Ambassador Samantha Power. Power is an imperialist war hawk who, as President Obama's national security advisor, persuaded him to intervene militarily in Libya. She has declared that her primary goal at USAID is to restore U.S. prestige by getting American-made vaccines into arms around the world. UNICEF's director, Anthony Lake, was President Bill Clinton's national security advisor and his nominee to be CIA director until corruption charges derailed his appointment. In January 2020, UNICEF telegraphed its brave new embrace of authoritarianism by cheerleading the Maldives legislature's passage of a bill making it a criminal offense for parents to decline any government-recommended vaccine for their children. UNICEF's unsheathed enthusiasm makes clear that the organization regards the Maldives' innovation as a pilot program for humanity. GlaxoSmithKline's spinoff, the Wellcome Trust, has played a central role in the marriage of Big Pharma to the Western spy agencies. From 2015 until October 2020, the chair of Wellcome Trust, the UK version of the Gates Foundation, was the former Director General of MI5, Dame Eliza Manningham Buller, a 35-year counter-espionage veteran who also functioned as official liaison between British and U.S. intelligence agencies. Anthony Fauci's emails reveal that Wellcome Trust Director Sir Jeremy Ferrer worked directly with Dr. Fauci to orchestrate the cover-up of the Wuhan lab leak evidence, assigning a staff of 5 Wellcome Trust operatives to manage the fraud. Dame Manningham Buller has served as chair of the Imperial College London since 2011. Anthony Fauci and Western health officials widely cited the Imperial College's inaccurate COVID-19 fatality projections, ginned up by the Wellcome Trust's notorious epidemiologist Neil Ferguson, to justify the draconian global lockdowns. Ferguson's guileful projections overestimated fatality rates by more than an order of magnitude. He did the same with mad cow disease and other diseases du jour. MI6 spy Christopher Steele is a leader of the British organization Independent Sage, a sketchy yet highly influential collective of social scientists, psychologists, and professional propagandists who use the news media to relentlessly pressure the UK government any time it hesitates to deploy the flinty authoritarianism needed to achieve zero COVID. Steele is only one of many former intelligence officers who cheerlead draconian responses to COVID and applaud the onset of totalitarianism. One of the early promoters of the marginalization, demonization, and officially sanctioned abuse of vaccine-hesitant parents is Juliette Kayyem, the former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under President Obama and former member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the National Committee on Terrorism, Khayyam was forced out of her high-level job at the Washington Post when critics leaked her involvement with the Israeli spyware company that makes the software system used to track and murder Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. As early as April 2019, she was editorializing for the Washington Post that parents who declined measles vaccines for their children should face isolation, fines, arrests, and be treated to the same sanctions that government uses against terrorists and sex offenders. As early as 1977, Watergate journalist Carl Bernstein documented the CIA's control over 400 leading American journalists and institutions, including the New York Times and Time magazine. The CIA's long and pervasive domination of the Washington Post via Project Mockingbird, beginning with its owners Catherine and Phil Graham and leading editors and reporters, is well documented. There is little evidence that its new owner, Jeff Bezos, has pruned away these corrupting influences. The Post and the Times have been the leading media cheerleaders for draconian pandemic response. On September 5th, Max Blumenthal, son of frequent Washington Post contributor Sidney Blumenthal, exposed the Post for publishing a phony doctor on the street interview, in which a supposedly typical D.C. physician called for extrajudicial murder of the vaccine-hesitant parents through medical neglect. Blumenthal pointed out that the physician was actually the vice president of technical staff at InQtel. The CIA and other intelligence agencies aggressively recruit scientists like Jeremy Ferrer, whose research involves postings in foreign countries. Additionally, it uses vaccination drives as a cover for broader strategic actions. Between 2011 and 2014, for example, the CIA used the WHO's Global Eradication Program to conduct fake polio and hepatitis B vaccine programs in Pakistan as a way to surreptitiously collect DNA from individuals in its efforts to track down Osama bin Laden. These are only a few of the myriad examples of the closely kept involvements by spy agencies in treating vaccination as a foreign policy tool and as an instrument of fear, suppression, and control, independent of any genuine health concerns. In July 2021, 1 year and 4 months into the misery of the global lockdown, the FAA had to divert air traffic over a section of the country stretching from the West Coast to Michigan to make room for the fleets of private jets converging on Sun Valley, Idaho, for the 38th annual meeting of the world's most exclusive conclave, sometimes called the Summer Camp for Billionaires or Mogul Fest. The 2021 meeting included Bill Gates, Apple CEO Tim Cook, Mark Zuckerberg, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, Mike Bloomberg, Google founders Larry Price and Sergey Brin, Warren Buffett, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings, Disney chair Robert Iger, Viacom CBS chair Sherry Redstone, and one of the lockdown's most influential propagandists, Anderson Cooper, who has acknowledged that he responded to a CIA recruitment poster while attending Yale and worked an indeterminate number of summers thereafter in Langley. All the discussions at the event were, as usual, closely guarded, but participants acknowledged conversing about cryptocurrencies and artificial intelligence. This year, the robber barons hosted as their guest of honor CIA Director William Joseph Burns, and by all reports, the mood among the titans was bullish. By that time, U.S. billionaires were well on their way to increasing their collective wealth by $3.8 trillion in a single year, while obliterating the American middle class, which permanently lost about the same amount. These tech and media magnates, who had magnified their billions from the lockdown, were the same men who had used their media and social media platforms to censor complaints about the lockdown. even as it filled their coffers past the bursting point. Each of these fat cats had helped grease the skids for the calamitous collapse of America's exemplary constitutional democracy. The Bill of Rights was by then indefinitely suspended. The participants of that event had privatized the public square and then obstructed the free flow of information and open debate, the oxygen and sunlight of democracy. Their censorship allowed their allies in the technocracy to effect the most extraordinary curtailment of American constitutional rights in history, closing churches across the country, shuttering a million businesses without due process or just compensation, suspending jury trials for corporate malefactors, passing regulations without constitutionally guaranteed transparency, public hearings, or comment, violating privacy through warrantless searches and track-and-trace surveillance, and abolishing the rights of assembly and association. After 20 years of modeling exercises, the CIA, working with medical technocrats like Anthony Fauci and billionaire internet tycoons, had pulled off the ultimate coup d'etat, some 250 years after America's historic revolt against entrenched oligarchy and authoritarian rule. The American experiment with self-government was over. The oligarchy was restored, and these gentlemen and their spy masters had equipped the rising technocracy with new tools of control unimaginable to King George or to any other tyrant in history. COVID-19, a military project. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. Dwight Eisenhower, 1961. With all the preparations for a coordinated military response, with deep involvement from intelligence agencies, it should come as no surprise that the government's COVID-19 response quickly emerged as a military project. On September 28, 2020, science journalist Nicholas Florko published in STAT a leaked organizational schematic exposing the $10 billion Operation Warp Speed project as a highly structured Defense Department campaign with vast military involvement. The Byzantine flowchart shows four generals and 60 other military officials commanding Operation Warp Speed, badly outnumbering civilian health technocrats from HHS, who represented a mere 29 of the roughly 90 leaders on the chart. HHS's Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, Paul Mengo, told STAT that the Department of Defense was deeply enmeshed in every aspect of the project, including creating more than 24 vaccine pop-up manufacturing plants, airlifting in equipment and raw materials from across the globe, and erecting cybersecurity and physical security operations to ensure an eventual vaccine is guarded very closely from state actors who don't want us to be successful in this. This paranoid addendum seems like a pretextual effort to link vaccine-hesitant Americans to sinister foreign governments, thereby justifying a military and intelligence agency response. It is, in short, a conspiracy theory, albeit an official one. Mengo told STAT that warp speed planning and debriefing occurs in protected rooms used to discuss classified information. A senior federal health official told STAT he was struck by the sight of soldiers in military uniforms ambling about HHS's headquarters in downtown Washington, including over 100 soldiers in the HHS corridors wearing Desert Storm fatigues. Health officials complained to STAT that they found themselves marginalized as Warp Speed devolved into a partnership between the military and the pharmaceutical industry, presided over by Robert Kadlec, who, according to Mango, personally signed off on every business agreement made by HHS for Operation Warp Speed. Warp Speed has secret deals with 6 major drug companies developing COVID-19 vaccines. The operation's chief advisor is Moncef Slaoui, a former GlaxoSmithKline official who prior to the pandemic served as chairman of Moderna, the Fauci-Kadlec-Gates collaboration that would be Warp Speed's primary beneficiary. By characterizing his post as an outside contractor, Slaoui, who holds roughly $10 million in GSK stock, dodged the application of federal ethics rules. Slaoui has since promised to donate any increase in the value of his stock. The first person to be fired should be Dr. Slaoui, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat, Massachusetts, responded at a hearing. The American people deserve to know that COVID-19 vaccine decisions are based on science and not on personal greed. Dr. Fauci had direct hands-on involvement with Warp Speed through his employee Larry Corey, who described himself as an ex officio member of the Warp Speed governance. Corey runs Dr. Fauci's COVID-19 Prevention Network, which transforms HIV clinical trial networks into Phase 3 COVID-19 clinical trials. Dr. Fauci was undaunted by the military takeover of U.S. health policy, applauding the operation as a talent show. Dr. Fauci told Stat he was untroubled by the dearth of public health experience among Warp Speed's Pentagon leadership. If you go through the organizational boxes of Operation Warp Speed, they're very, very impressive. Tom Inglesby also lauded the military involvement. There is deep knowledge of science and on how to manage complex government operations, said Inglesby. It's clearly operating in a challenging pandemic and political environment, and we won't know if we have a safe and effective vaccine until the trials are finished. But it's a highly competent group of people working to make it happen. HHS Secretary Alex Azar, a former pharma CEO and lobbyist, and Defense Secretary Mark Esper share top billing as the organizational chairs. Slaoui, the project's formal civilian leader, and General Gustav Perna serve as Operation Warp Speed's CEO. Immediately beneath Perna and Slaoui are Lieutenant General retired Paul Ostrowski, a former Special Forces soldier who manages distribution of an eventual vaccine, and Matt Hepburn, who specializes in futuristic warfare projects for the Pentagon, including a program to implant high-tech sensors into soldiers to detect illnesses and for other purposes. This should be a medical and not be a military operation, Holocaust survivor and medical ethics advocate Vera Sharov told me. It's a public health problem. Why are the military and the CIA so heavily involved? Why is everything a secret? Why can't we know the ingredients of these products which the taxpayers financed? Why are all their emails redacted? Why can't we see the contracts with vaccine manufacturers? Why are we mandating a treatment with an experimental technology with minimal testing? Since COVID-19 harms fewer than 1%, what is the justification for putting 100% of the population at risk? We need to recognize that this is a vast human experiment on all of mankind with an unproven technology, conducted by spies and generals primarily trained to kill and not to save lives. What could possibly go wrong? Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments and notes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook.